Thus, they were able to create, virtually, a paradise over the whole continent. Rivers and springs never dried up, but flowed lazily across the numerous plains of a land that was essentially flat. Fruit trees were laden with fruit, bowing under the weight of oranges, mandarins or apples, according to latitude. Exotic fruits, of kinds that actually no longer exist on Earth, were harvested in abundance. One such fruit, called the lycote, possessed a property that caused an excitation of brain activity, allowing whoever ate it to solve problems which would normally be beyond them. This property was not actually a drug, but the fruit was, nevertheless, condemned by the sages. The lycote was only authorized to be planted in the gardens of the king. In writing this book, I feel it is interesting to emphasize the striking similarity between this prohibition from eating the lycote, for reasons relating to knowledge, and, in the Bible, Adam being forbidden to eat the apple on similar grounds. Author's comment: man being what he is, however, the fruit was secretly planted in various places throughout the continent. Those caught with the fruit were harshly punished, for they had directly disobeyed the king of Mu. In matters of religion and government, he was to be obeyed absolutely, as he was the representative of the Great Spirit. As such, the king was not one to be worshipped, he simply represented another. Those people believed in Tharoa, the God, the Spirit, the one and only, the creator of all things, and, of course, they believed in reincarnation. What concerns us here, Michelle, are the great events which occurred on your planet, in times long gone, so that you will be able to enlighten your people. I won't, therefore, elaborate on my description of the continent that was home to one of the best organized civilizations to have existed on Earth. However, you should know that, after a period of 50,000 years, the population of Mu was 80 million. Expeditions were undertaken regularly, to explore and research aspects of the planet. For these expeditions, they used flying ships, similar to what you call flying saucers. It was known that most of the planet was populated by black, yellow and also white races, although the latter had regressed into a primitive state due to their loss of technical understanding right at the beginning. These white people had actually arrived on Earth in very small numbers at a time in between the arrival of the Bacaratinians and the colonizing of Mu. They had settled on a continent known to you as Atlantis, but, as much for material as spiritual reasons, their civilization failed completely. What do you mean by material reasons? Natural disasters, which effectively destroyed their towns and almost all that might have allowed them to advance technologically. I must emphasize the following point: prior to embarking on their exploratory expeditions of the planet, the inhabitants of Mu had conducted research by means of the Pyramid of Savanazar. As a result of this research, it was decided to send forth the flying ships and to colonize New Guinea and the southern Asiatic region, that is, all to the west of Mu. Simultaneously, they set up colonies in South America and Central America. Most importantly, they established a colonial base, which grew into a huge town, in the area known to your archaeologists as Thacuano, located not far from Lake Titicaca. The Andes did not exist at the time. The mountains formed some time later, as you will soon see. At Thacuano, an enormous seaport was built. In those days, North and South America were flat, and eventually, a canal was constructed to link an inland sea, existing where Brazil is now, with the Pacific Ocean. This sea also had an outlet into the Atlantic Ocean, so that it was possible to pass from one ocean to the other and so, to colonize the continent of Atlantis. But you say they had flying ships, why wouldn't they use them? If they pierced a canal, they must have intended to use boats. They used their flying machines just as you now use aeroplanes, Michelle, but for very heavy loads, they used machines of anti-gravitation, exactly like the heavy vehicles are now used on Earth. So, as I said, they colonized the continent of Atlantis. Many white people from Atlantis preferred, at the time, to emigrate to the region of Northern Europe, as they didn't accept the new government and the new religion coming from Mu. These white people set off in their sea vessels propelled by steam and wind. Indeed, the white race had discovered steam power, having passed through a period you would call prehistoric. I must also explain that Britain was not an island, at this time as it was joined to Northern Europe, and the Straits of Gibraltar didn't exist either, as Africa reached to the south of Europe. Many white people from Atlantis emigrated to North Africa, mixing with the crossbred black-yellow race of the area. Interbreeding created new races in North Africa, which have perpetuated themselves over thousands of years and which you know as Berbers, Tuaregs and others. We often visited Earth during those times. When we judged the time opportune, we went overtly, to visit the King of Mu and, according to his request or the information he gave us, we would visit the new colonies. In India, for example, or in New Guinea, the people of Mu sometimes experienced great difficulties assimilating their civilization with that already in existence. We would arrive, openly and publicly, in vessels quite like the one that brought you to Thiouba, although different in shape. Our size, which has always been large, and our radiant beauty, meant that we passed as gods in the eyes of people who were not greatly advanced and, in some cases, were even cannibals. According to our mission, it was important that we impress as friendly gods in the eyes of the colonizers so that war could be avoided, something which they abhorred on account of their advancement, their beliefs and their religion. It is because of our frequent visits, during this period, that there are so many legends on Earth, describing giants and chariots of fire from the heavens. We were great friends with the inhabitants of Mu, and my astral entity at the time existed in a body quite similar to the one I'm wearing now. Artists and sculptors gave us much consideration. They consulted the King of Mu and, with his consent, worked to immortalize us. The immense statues at Hulleton Hulleton, Easter Island, was situated at the southeast of the continent of Mu, are examples of such work. They were, for the civilization of the time, the ultimate of great art, being in size and shape what you would describe as stylized. We can compare this process with a 9-stage filter, intended to rid the water passing through, of 9 elements. At the end of stage 1 in the process, 1 will have been completely eliminated, with 8 remaining. Of course, to make this information easier to digest, I am making enormous use of imagery. This astral body then will have completed its cycle with the higher self of the first category and will then detach itself from higher self number 1 to rejoin the higher self of the second category. The entire process will be repeated. By the same token, the astral body will be sufficiently spiritually advanced to pass to a planet of the next category as well. I see you are not following me very well, and I am anxious that you will understand absolutely all that I explain to you. In his wisdom, the Spirit, by means of the fourth force, provided for 9 categories of planets. At present, you are on the planet Thiouba, which is in the 9th category, that is, at the top of the scale. Earth is a planet of the first category and therefore at the bottom of the scale. What does this mean? The planet Earth could be likened to a kindergarten with the emphasis on teaching basic social values. A planet of the second category would then correspond with a primary school where further values are taught. In both schools, adult guidance is imperative. The third category would comprise secondary schools where a foundation of values allows exploration beyond. Next, you would go to university, where you are treated as an adult, for you would not only have attained a certain amount of knowledge, but you would also start to accept civic responsibility. This is the type of progress occurring with the 9 categories of planets. The more spiritually advanced you are, the more you will benefit, on a superior planet, by an environment and general way of life which is superior. The very way in which you procure food is much easier, which in turn simplifies the process of organizing your way of life. The consequence is more effective spiritual development. On the higher planets, nature itself enters the stage to assist the pupil, and by the time you reach planets of the 6th, 7th, 8th and 9th category, not only is your astral body highly evolved, Your physical body has also benefited from your development. We know you have already been favorably impressed by what you have seen on our planet. As you see more, you will appreciate that it is what you would call on Earth, a paradise, and yet, compared with true happiness, when you become a pure spirit, it is still nothing. I must be careful not to make this explanation too long, for you must report it word for word, changing nothing in the book that you will write. It is absolutely essential you allow no personal opinion to intrude. No, don't get anxious, Thou will help you with the details when the time comes to start writing. From this planet, it is possible either to remain in a physical body or be reunited with the Great Spirit in the ether. As these words were uttered, the aura surrounding the leader shone more brightly than ever, and I was surprised to see him almost disappear in a golden mist, only to reappear a second later. You have understood that the astral body is a body which inhabits your physical body, recalling and noting all the understanding acquired during the course of its various lives. It can only be enriched spiritually, not materially. The physical body is merely a vehicle which, in most cases, we abandon when we die. I will elaborate, for I see that in most cases has confused you. By this, I mean that some of us, including all on our planet, are able to regenerate the cells of our bodies at will. Yes, you have already noticed that most of us seem to be of the same age. We are one of three planets that are the most highly evolved in this galaxy. Some of us can, and do, directly join what we call the Great Ether. So, on this particular planet, we have arrived at a stage near perfection, both materially and spiritually. But we have our roles to perform, as does every creature existing in the universe. In fact, everything, including a single pebble, has its role. Our role, as beings of a superior planet, is to guide, to help with spiritual development and even, sometimes, materially. We are in a position to give material assistance because we are technologically the most advanced people. Indeed, how could a father give spiritual guidance to his child if he were not older, more educated and more skilled in diplomacy than the child? If the child should require physical punishment, as unfortunately, is sometimes the case, isn't it important that the parent be physically stronger than the child? Certain adults, who refuse to listen and who are absolutely stubborn, also need to be corrected by physical means. You, Michelle, come from the planet Earth, which is sometimes called the planet of sorrows. Indeed, the name is appropriate, but it is this way for a precise reason. It is intended to provide a learning environment of a quite specific kind. It is not because life there is so difficult that you have to intervene. You cannot lightly go against nature, destroying rather than conserving what the Creator has put at your disposal, that is, interfering with ecological systems, which have been intricately designed. Certain countries, like Australia, where you are from, are beginning to show great respect for ecology, and it is a step in the right direction. But even in that country, what case is made of pollution, both water and air pollution? What is ever done about one of the worst forms of pollution? Noise. I say worst because people such as Australians pay virtually no attention to it at all. Ask someone if traffic noise bothers him and the response will surprise you. 85% of the time it will be, "What noise? What are you talking about?" Oh, that noise, we get used to it. And it is precisely because they get used to it that the danger exists. Just then, Thora, as this high figure was called, made a gesture and I turned around. He was replying to a question I had mentally posed: how can he speak of percentages and know so much about our planet with so much precision? Turning around, I almost uttered a cry of surprise, for, behind me, stood Biastra and Latley. In itself, this was nothing surprising, but the friends I knew who measured 310 and 280 centimeters in height respectively, were now reduced in size to correspond with my height. My mouth must have continued to gape, for Thora smiled. Can you understand, that sometimes, and very often in these days, some of us live among your people on Earth, and there is my answer to your question. To continue on the very important subject of noise, it is such a danger that, if nothing is done, catastrophe is certain. Let us take the example of a discotheque. The people who expose themselves to music that is typically played 3 times too loudly, are subjecting their brains and their physiological and astral bodies to vibrations which are so harmful. If they could see the damage that is caused, they would vacate the discotheque quicker than if there was a fire. But vibrations don't only come from noise. They also come from colors, and it is astonishing that, on your planet, experiments conducted in this field have not been followed up. Our agents reported a particular experiment involving a man who was capable of lifting a certain weight. It was found that editor's edition, after staring for a moment at a pink-colored screen, he consistently lost 30% of his strength. Your civilization pays no attention to such experimentation. In fact, colors can enormously influence the behavior of human beings, and yet, control of this influence requires that an individual's aura be taken into account. If, for example, you want to paint or wallpaper your bedroom with the colors that are truly appropriate for you, you must be aware of the colors of certain principal points of your aura. By matching the colors of your walls with those of your aura, you can improve your health or maintain good health. Further, the vibrations emanating from these colors are essential for good mental balance, exerting their influence even while you sleep. I was wondering how we could be expected to know these significant colors in our auras when, on Earth, we were not capable of perceiving auras. Of course, Thora replied immediately, without me having to say a word aloud. Michelle, it is now very important that your experts invent the special equipment necessary to enable perception of the aura, as this, in turn, will ensure that correct choices are made at the critical crossroads ahead. The Russians have already photographed the aura. This is the beginning, but the results obtained allow them only to read the first 2 letters of the alphabet, as it were, in comparison with what we are able to decipher. The reading of the aura in order to heal the physical body is nothing compared with what such a reading can achieve for the psychic body, or the physiological body. It is in the area of the psyche that, on Earth, your greatest problems exist. At the moment, most responsibility is taken for the physical body, but this is a serious mistake. If your psyche is poor, it will influence your physical appearance accordingly, but, regardless, your physical body will wear out and die one day, whereas your psyche, being part of your astral body, never dies. On the contrary, the more you cultivate your mind, the less you will be burdened by your physical body and the quicker you will proceed through your cycle of lives. We could have brought you to our planet in astral body, but instead, we have brought you here in physical body, and for an important reason. I see you already understand our reason. This pleases us, and we thank you for your willingness to assist us in our task. The Thora stopped talking and seemed to lapse into thought, at the same time, fixing me with his luminous eyes. I cannot say how much time elapsed. I know my state became more and more euphoric, and I was aware that the auras of the 7 personages were gradually changing. The colors became more vivid in places, softer in others, while the outer edges became misty. This mist became more golden and pink as it spread, gradually blurring the 7 figures. I felt Thau's hand on my shoulder. No, you are not dreaming, Michelle. It's all quite real. She spoke very loudly and, as if to prove her point, she pinched my shoulder so hard, she left a bruise that could be seen for several weeks. Why did you do that? I would not have thought you capable of such violence, Thau. I'm sorry, Michelle, but sometimes strange means are employed. The Thari always disappear, and sometimes appear in this manner, and you might have thought it part of a dream. I am entrusted with the task of ensuring that you recognize what is real. With these words, Thau pivoted me around and I followed her, as we departed by the same route we had come. Chapter 7. The Continent of Mu and Easter Island. Before leaving the Doko, Thau fitted a mask on my head, a mask that was different from the one I'd worn previously. I was able to see colors that were much more vivid and much more luminous. How do you feel in your new Vokey, Michelle? Do you find the light tolerable?
Yes. It's fine. It's so beautiful and I feel so.
With that, I collapsed at Thao's feet. She took me in her arms and carried me to the flying platform. I awoke in my doko, quite astonished. My shoulder was hurting. Quite instinctively I put my hand to the pain, and grimaced. I am really sorry, Michelle, but it was necessary. There was just a hint of remorse in Thao's expression. What happened to me? Let's say that you fainted, although the word is not quite appropriate. Rather, you were overwhelmed with beauty. Your new Vokey allows 50% of the vibrations of color on our planet to pass, whereas your former Vokey subdued all but 20%. Only 20%, that's incredible. All those marvelous colors I could see, the butterflies, the flowers, the trees, the ocean. No wonder I was overcome. I remember, during a journey I made from France to New Caledonia, we called in at the island of Tahiti. While there, I toured the island with family and friends, in a hired car. The islanders were delightful and made such a charming picture, with their straw hats constructed on the banks of lagoons amidst bougainvillea, hibiscus and exeras, red, yellow, orange and purple, surrounded by well-kept lawns and shaded by coconut trees. The backdrop to these scenes was provided by the blue of the ocean. We spent all day touring the island and I described it in my journal as having been an entire day of inebriation for my eyes. I was, indeed, intoxicated by the beauty around me, and yet, now, I admit all that was nothing compared with the beauty here on your planet. Thao had listened to my description with marked interest, smiling all the while. She placed her hand on my forehead and said, "Rest now, Michelle. Later you will feel better and will be able to come with me." I fell asleep immediately and slept peacefully, without dreaming, I think for about 24 hours. When I awoke, I felt rested and refreshed. Thao was there, and Latli and Biastra had joined her. They had regained their normal size and I commented on the fact straight away. "Little time is required for such a metamorphose, Michelle," explained Biastra, "but that is not important. Today we are going to show you something of our country and introduce you to some very interesting people." Latli approached me and touched my shoulder with her fingertips, just where Thao had bruised me. Instantly, the pain vanished and I felt quivers of well-being run through my whole body. She returned my smile and handed me my new mask. I still found that, outside, I had to squint against the light. Thao gestured to me, indicating that I should climb onto the Lativukasa flying platform was called. The others chose to fly independently, fluttering about our vehicle, as though playing a game, and no doubt they were. On this planet, the inhabitants seemed perpetually happy, the only ones I had found to be serious, in fact, even a little severe, despite their air of benevolence, were the seven Thari. Thari is the plural of Thora. We flew at high speed, several meters above the water and, although my curiosity was constantly aroused, I often had to close my eyes to allow them to recover from the brightness. Still, it appeared I was going to become accustomed to it. I wondered how I would cope though, if it occurred to Thao to give me a mask which permitted 70% of the light to penetrate, or even more. We rapidly approached the coast of the mainland, where waves were breaking over rocks of green, black, orange and gold. The iridescence of the water, crashing against the rocks, under the perpendicular rays of a midday sun, created a memorably lovely effect. A band of light and color was formed, 100 times more crystalline than a rainbow on Earth. We rose to an altitude of about 200 meters and proceeded to travel over the continent. Thao flew us over a plain on which I could see animals of all sorts. Some were two-legged and resembled little ostriches, others were four-legged creatures, similar to mammoths, but twice as big. I also watched cows graze side by side with hippopotamuses. The cows were so similar to those we have on Earth, I couldn't help but remark on it to Thao, pointing as I did so, at a particular herd,
just like an excited child at the zoo. She laughed heartily. Why shouldn't we have cows here, Michelle? Look over there and you'll see donkeys and there, giraffes, although they are somewhat taller than on Earth. See how lovely those horses are as they run together. I was thrilled, but wasn't I constantly thrilled by this experience, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less? What really rendered me speechless, to the amusement of my friends, was the sight of horses bearing the heads of very pretty women, some blonde, others auburn or brown, and even some with blue hair. As they galloped, they would often soar for tens of meters. Ah yes. In fact, they had wings, folded back against their bodies, which they made use of from time to time, something like the flying fish which follow or precede ships. They lifted their heads to see us and tried to rival the speed of the Leytivok. Thou reduced speed and altitude, enabling us to approach within several meters of them. There were more surprises ahead of me, as some of these horsewomen cried out to us in a language that was recognizably human. My three companions answered in the same language, and the exchange was obviously a pleasant one. We didn't linger long at the low altitude, however, as some of the horsewomen soared to such heights, they almost touched our vehicle, thereby risking injury to themselves. The plain we flew over was, in places, embossed with small knolls, all of about the same size. I remarked on them and Bystro explained that, millions of years ago, these knolls had been volcanoes. The vegetation below us had none of the exuberance of the forest I had experienced on my arrival. On the contrary, here the trees were grouped in small stands, reaching no more than 25 meters in height. As we passed, large white birds took flight by the hundreds, only to land again, a safe distance away. A wide water course flowed to the horizon, dissecting the plain with its lazy wanderings. I could make out some small docos grouped together on a bend of the river. Thou guided the Leytivok above the river, reducing altitude to water level as we approached the settlement. We landed in a small square between two docos and were immediately surrounded by the inhabitants. They didn't scramble or push to get near us, rather, they stopped what they were doing and calmly approached us. They formed a circle large enough to be comfortable and for all to have equal opportunity to see an alien face to face. Again, it struck me that these people all seemed to be of the same age, apart from about half a dozen who could have been older. Age, here, did not detract but added a quality of surprising nobility. I had also been struck by the absence of children on the planet, and yet, in this settlement and among the crowd that approached, I saw six or seven of them. They were charming and appeared to be quite level-headed for children. According to Thau, they would have been 8 or 9 years old. Since my arrival on Thiuba, I had not yet had occasion to meet so great a number of these people. Glancing around the circle, I could appreciate a calmness and reserve about them, as well as the great beauty in their faces that I'd grown to expect. There was a strong resemblance between them, as if they were all brothers and sisters, and yet, isn't that our first impression when we encounter a group of blacks or Asians together? In fact, the same physical variety in facial features existed among these people, as exists within races on Earth. In height, they varied from 280 to 300 centimeters, their bodies being so well proportioned, they were a pleasure to behold, neither too muscular nor too puny, and without deformity of any kind. Their hips were somewhat larger than you would expect in a man, but then I'd been told that some of them gave birth to children. All possessed magnificent heads of hair, most of a golden blonde color, others platinum blonde or coppery blonde and occasionally, a bright chestnut color. There were also some, like Thau and Bystro, with a fine down of hair on the upper lip, but, apart from this, these people had absolutely no other body hair. This is not, of course, an observation that I made at the time but one which I made later, When I had occasion to see from quite near, a group of naked sunbathers, their skin type reminded me of Arab women who protect themselves from the sun. It was certainly not the pale skin typical of blondes with such light eyes. So light, indeed, were the mauve and blue eyes around me, that I might have wondered if they were blind, had I been on Earth.